This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, world. This is the Global Media and Communication podcast series. I am Aswin Punathambekar, the director of the Center for Advanced Research in Global Communication.
This is Jing Wang, the senior research manager at CARC.
Our podcast is part of a multimodal project powered by CARG here at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania.
At CARG, we produce and promote critical, interdisciplinary, and multimodal research on global media and communication. We aim to bridge academic scholarship and public life, bringing the very best scholarship to bear on enduring global questions and pressing contemporary issues.
Hi, listeners. Welcome to the podcast, Global Media and Communication. I'm your host today. My name is Florence Madenga, and I'm a doctoral candidate at the Annenberg School for Communication and a doctoral fellow at the Center for Advanced Research in Global Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Today, our guest, Dr. Julia Ticona, is the author of Left to Our Own Devices, Coping with Insecure Work in a Digital Age, published in 2022 by Oxford University Press. Dr. Ticona, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Julia Ticona. I am an assistant professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. I am a researcher, I'm a teacher, I'm based in the United States. I research people who live and work in the United States for the most part, but I am utterly indebted to and inspired by global communication scholarship, which is why I'm really excited to be here today.
So excited to have you. So first, before we start, I really, really want to say how much I loved reading this book. It's really enjoyable. It's well written. It's very accessible. And it does pack a lot of theory and a lot of methods. So a lot of work went into it.
Yeah, thank you.
And a lot of time. This is also your first book, which also, to me, felt incredible. You started this a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us a little bit about the beginning of this book, how you even got to this idea, what first sparked your interest in the topic, and how you began sort of conceptualizing some of the key points and arguments in here?
Yeah. I mean, this was my dissertation research, right? Oh, so this is like the dissertation book that took a really long time to come out. And I think, we can get to this a little bit later, but I think it ended up working nicely because in a lot of ways, even though I did not plan for this at all, the public discourse about technology and work kind of caught up to me as I was doing this work, which as a graduate student is both really exciting and opportune kind of thing to happen, but also utterly terrifying, right? Because you're absolutely concerned that the moment's just going to pass you by and run you over, or your work is not going to be, relevant to this big public conversation that's happening now.
Yeah.
So when I think about what kind of inspired this book, it's kind of a two-part answer, I guess, because there's the answer of why I was inspired to do the research to begin with, And then there's the second kind of answer, which is how I was inspired to kind of talk about it in the way that I talk about it, or write this book in the way that I wrote it.
Yeah.
So the first was that, you know, I've like always been fascinated by technology and popular understandings of technology. I came up kind of in the era where, you know, in high school, we were still like scrimping and saving and like begging our parents to allow us to have cell phones, right? It just wasn't like an everyday part of our lives yet. And I was totally fascinated by the big feelings that people seem to have, the adults in my life and the you know, my peers, about technology. Just everybody had an opinion about it. Everybody had a fear, a hope, a desire, a something of about these things that seem to be, you know, taking over our lives in different ways. And as somebody who loves to talk to people and like to talk to them about how they're feeling, it's an ideal way to get people to talk about their feelings, right? Because yeah, they're yeah. just, everybody has these big feelings about them. And the other thing that was important to me is, you know, I was reading a little bit at this time, you know, even pretty early on, like in my undergrad kind of years, about technology. And, you know, I was reading these books by these like engineer public figure type people like Ray Kurzweil and these futurist type people. Science fiction, things like that, and other kinds of like elite discourses about technology, trying to understand like what are we all worried about or what are we talking about here. And I realized more and more that those, that kind of writing, that kind of discourse was not what I was interested in. I was really interested in like the backyard conversation or the bar conversation or yeah. the kitchen table conversation about like how people talk about this stuff in their everyday lives and how they make sense of it in their everyday lives, right? Yeah. Not separate from these like elite discourses, but you know, in a different way than they were being articulated. And then the second kind of piece of this was when I started to write this into a book, right? When, because basically the way the research proceeded was I conceptualized this research project as a PhD student in pre-Uber times, right? Long time ago, right? And I was, you know, happy on my way, doing my research, recruiting, trying to find people to talk to me, being aggressively friendly, as you've heard me say before, about how to do qualitative research. And all of a sudden, like, Travis Kalanick happened. And, you know, the CEO, this, like, big bad boy, brash CEO of Uber was, like, taking over the media cycle. And everybody was talking about, in the post, kind of, 2009 recession world, about these, the quote-unquote gig economy and all these platforms and apps that this very small proportion of workers were using in a very public way in order to navigate this quote-unquote new world of work that we were in, right, in the post-2009-2007 recession. And that kind of stopped me in my tracks for a bunch of different reasons, not only because I felt like I had been doing this for a little while and what I wanted to say was not being reflected in that large public conversation at all, right? I was talking to people who did not have quote-unquote technology jobs, who were not using Uber, who were not using Lyft or any particular dedicated platform, but who were doing work all over the economy in lots of different kinds of jobs and still like grappling with the effects of the recession and using technology in this really important way. And those folks were completely left out of this conversation. And so when I was panicking about what do I do with this research project that does not seem to be speaking to, does not seem to be included in this huge public conversation that's happening, instead of being, or I shouldn't say instead of, in addition to being terrified that the news cycle was going to eat my lunch as a researcher, right? And nobody was going to care what I had to say because I'm not talking to Uber drivers. I started to think about, like, what are they missing, right? Like, what am I saying? Who are these folks that I've spent so much time with? Who am I talking to that needs to be heard in that larger conversation and is not being heard? So that's kind of how I started to turn the dissertation project into a book that I hoped would have some kind of something to say to this larger public conversation.
Yeah, and I will say it was really refreshing to read this and see things that I think like real people would say. So not that scholars and policymakers are not real people, but like how people actually talk about technology in the daily lives, like people I know, and how they would answer some of these questions. Right, so that was, enjoyed that. enjoyed all the interviews. And sort of on that note, I wanted to ask, who is the audience for this? Mm-hmm. So obviously I have a hunch that scholars need to read this, who care about the digital, mm-hmm. As well as policymakers, mm-hmm. which is also, I think, maybe you can talk a little bit about your writing style and maybe some of the people you were targeting mm-hmm. as audiences. Mm-hmm. But I'm mm-hmm. curious to know if there are other people as well mm-hmm. That you were thinking of. And I really also appreciated how when you were talking about some of your interviewees or your interlocutors in here, you had a line that said you hoped you'd gotten it right. and I really, that was really great to just sort of solidify that relationship you had with them as people.
I am sure that I didn't get it 100% right, but yeah, it is still my hope that I did. I think, you know, a lot of this comes from, as far as, you know, thinking about audience, when I think about, you know, who the audience I wanted to be for the book, when I was thinking about it as a PhD student, I'm a first generation academic, right? Like I don't have I didn't have a whole lot of experience in this industry, in this area, before deciding that I wanted to go to school forever and never leave. And it was news to me that scholars should be the main audience for my book. and I never, when I always wanted to write books, I never really wanted to write for other scholars, really. Like, I just didn't think that that was my role, right? Like, it wasn't necessarily what I felt called to do at the time. I think now that I am a bit more, that I've gotten, you know, I've written this book and I see the way that these conversations take shape, I see the power that I have and the privilege that I have in speaking to other scholars and generating ideas in that way. And I think I have a different perspective on that now than I did as a PhD student. But so this is just the way that I write, right? Like it's not a conscious choice. It's just kind of the way it comes out. But I always kind of felt, thinking about it a little bit after the fact, that it seems strange to me as a person who considers himself a critical scholar, right? Mm-hmm. That I always felt like the people who I'm writing about, their lives, should want to read the book or be able to read it and get something out of it or see themselves in some way in the book. And to maybe be able to think about their what felt like personal struggles in a different way, right? So this is, I'm trained as a sociologist, and this is like a classic sociological, you know, understanding of like what sociology is supposed to do, especially thinking about, you know, we often call it public sociology, right? Which is like sociology that's aimed at a larger audience beyond just other academics. Where, you know, it's our job, it's a part of our duty, once we are trained in this way of seeing the world, to put people's personal individual experiences into a different kind of context and to say like, hey, it's not just you, right? That, you know, this is these social problems, what these things that feel like individual problems are actually social problems that have these societal contours, right? And it's not just because you are bad at using your phone. It is because it's how it's set up, right? It's how your job is set up. It's how, you know, society is set up right now in some ways against you. And so, or for you, right? As I talk about with the high wage workers. So I think that was a big part of, you know, how naively maybe how I understood the audience of the book primarily, I would say, when I started out. But since then, I think, you know, I've been more aware of, you know, what this bucket of like policymakers, like how varied that bucket is of people. There's so many folks whose job titles could fall under that and who touch social policy in a lot of different ways, including other researchers who are not academics, but who are in the research sphere. I was able to do a stint at the Data and Society Research Institute in New York and as a postdoc, and that really kind of broadened my understanding of like what can social science research do and how it can be influential in some exciting ways and also in potentially some deeply problematic ways, right? As to the amount of power that we have as social researchers to influence the framing of particular kinds of conversations. So that was on my mind also as I was kind of writing this book, is not just ivory tower kind of academics, but people who are nonetheless trained as social science, but who are, you know, in more industry spaces, shall we say.
Yeah. And speaking of industries, so yeah, the more I read through the book, the more I realized, like, all the things you're saying about the gig economy touch mm-hmm. everybody, so mm. they apply to so many industries. And yet, you had a very specific way. Also, you have a really good methods section in the back, which I really appreciated.
I love a methods appendix. Thank
yes.
you.
So obviously, you know, you didn't have all the time in the world. You had to pick a certain number of respondents mm-hmm. and you had four very specific locations mm-hmm. where you mm-hmm. were doing your interviews. And you also let your respondents pick where they were talking to you, mm-hmm. Which was really cool. So can you take us through the process of who you talked to mm-hmm. and why? How did you even get to this? I hate to say the word sample, but yes, sample.
Yeah.
Doing the social sciences. Were there any sort of surprising things you found as you were doing yeah. this? Is there anything you'd do differently now, sort of looking back?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So I came at this, designing this project from this tradition of looking at work through organizations, right? Yeah. So again, trained as a sociologist, there's this long tradition of organization kind of workplace studies, right? So the sociologist comes from the outside, sets up camp in a meeting room or in a break room or, you know, maybe crouched outside on a sidewalk trying to talk to workers and management or whoever in a particular workplace,
yeah.
right? When I decided to study contingent and independent workers, though, what I realized was they don't really have one workplace, right? They
yeah.
actually have a ton of different workplaces. Sometimes even on the same day, they have a bunch of different workplaces. So I wasn't necessarily able to do that. And I had to find a different way to meet these folks and to kind of figure out who was going to be included in that study. And so what I realized as I was, you know, getting to know this space a little bit more, talking to friends who were, in my mind, the ideal interviewee and saying, like, okay, if I wanted to find you, right, like, how would I find you
yeah.
In recruitment? I realized that a big way that these workers encounter their technology and the types of technologies that I was interested in talking to them about were through consumer technology stores, right? Like retail locations of where they had to buy these things, where they went to research them, where they went to hold them, where they went to ask questions when the stuff broke. And as independent workers, as contingent workers, that's a large part of like how they got the tech into their lives, right?
Yeah.
Once I kind of landed on that, I decided I had to learn more about technology retail in the US, like consumer retail. And once I realized that digital tech retail in the US is extremely segregated by class and often by neighborhood in terms of the types of stores that cater to different kinds of income demographics, I thought this is a perfect prism to understand social class, right? And a perfect way that I can start approaching people who are likely to have these different kinds of jobs, white collar jobs and kind of more low income service jobs, by meeting them in stores, right? Where they're actually purchasing this stuff or really outside of the stores where they were purchasing stuff because sometimes I was not allowed into the store. So that was how I ended up picking that way of like recruiting people and how I actually constructed the sample. In terms of geography, so, you know, a lot of talk about digital inequalities in the United States is about home internet access.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big way that we measure like who has, you know, who is more connected and who isn't, is largely through home internet consumption. And what I knew at the time was that it's deeply segregated based on geography, right? So we have like really poor connection rates in more rural areas. We have better connection rates in urban areas, but even within urban areas, it's like deeply segregated based on neighborhood, right? And the suburbs are kind of somewhere in between, and it kind of depends on like how proximate you are to an urban area or not. So when I was constructing the sample, I also felt like that was a really important aspect to get into this, right? Because people's feelings about their connection is probably going to be deeply shaped by how good those connections are and how necessary they felt in their everyday lives, right? So it could be that, you know, this intense dependence that I was seeing in my urban sample just wasn't going to be there for the folks in the rural areas, right? That wasn't necessarily the case, actually.
Yeah.
And maybe that was something a bit more surprising that I found.
Yeah.
Is there anything I would do differently? Always. Always. That's why we keep writing books, right? Yes. I think looking back at it, the thing, and I write about this in the methods appendix a little bit, is the thing that is missing in a really glaring way from this book that I've tried to kind of remedy with an article that came out after the book was published is race, right? That both in the people who are in these different types of jobs, right? So we look at workers who are segmented into the parts of the labor market that I was studying. Mm-hmm. Those trends are deeply shaped on race, right? Are deeply shaped by racial inequalities in the labor market in general, right? Who, quote unquote, opts into or chooses these jobs has to do with who gets shut out of other parts of the labor market, right? Yeah. So that's really important and something that I didn't see as central to the study and that subsequently became very obvious that it was very central to the study. So that's one thing that I wish I had thought of earlier, and that an article that I wrote that came out last year, 2 years ago? What year is it? I don't know. It's called Policing the Digital Divide. I wrote it with Yif Lelkis and Tian Yang, a PhD student, now not a PhD student anymore, from Annenberg. Was kind of trying to understand quantitatively, right, like how neighborhood and race intersect to shape who has access to the internet in more public spaces. And I'm also going to be looking more centrally at race in my upcoming book project, which I'm also excited about. And then the second is, that's the major regret, I would say. The second regret is, man, I would have really liked to talk to more employers. That I really would have loved to talk to the managers of these independent contingent workers, where I could have. I had some bosses in the study just because they were also contingent workers, right? They were also running their own business and they had a couple of employees, right? So I kind of got that a little bit, but it was mostly by accident. And it wasn't because it was something I sought out. And I should say, this is a tradition in, I would say a problematic tradition in the sociology of work and labor, is really understanding these issues from a worker side perspective first, which I think is not necessarily a bad thing, and then kind of asking the more relational questions about, like, okay, well, how are these dynamics produced, right? How does the employment relation actually shape the way that these workers feel policed when they use their technologies, or they feel pressured to put them away in their locker, or they feel like their manager who's on shift tonight is cool, and so I'm gonna keep it in my apron pocket, right? Like, how does that work from the manager's perspective, I think is another thing that I would do differently next time.
Yeah, I was thinking about that in the anecdotes where folks are talking about, yeah, being surveyed in the warehouse, and I was thinking about, like, who's doing the surveying, and, like, how much pressure are they under,
right,
and then sort of how high up are we going, and how we define a worker. So yeah, really interesting that, and I was also thinking about in the pandemic how, you know, when people, well, we're still in the pandemic, but when folks, especially more the tech workers that I've been talking to, or people that are sort of doing on-screen work, the ways that people were then being surveyed in their homes, and how they were all trying to circumvent that by, I don't know, like moving the mouse certain ways, or getting clickers, and things like that.
The mouse jigglers.
Yeah, and how you know, how that, you know, that stuff was happening in the warehouse, but, like, sort of very similar dynamics were also still there. And now sort of, like, across what we see as class differences, right? So yes, about this pandemic.
About that.
A lot of it, yeah. A lot of what you've been saying is really salient, I think. So you did, like you said, you did start working on this book, a lot of the things in this book, before the pandemic in 2013. But you sort of don't mention anything about it until towards the end of the book. So you sort of leave us to our thoughts and speculations until about the last chapter of the book. So how has the ongoing pandemic influenced or even changed maybe some of your initial thoughts about where this book could go, or, like, what it could apply to?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about more, it's more of an observation than really, like, you know, a finding or a conclusion of the book, but in the chapter, in one of the chapters on low-wage workers, I point out that this pressure to brand oneself, right, to kind of appear as a productive and completely having it all together kind of worker and person on social media, that has become more of an expectation of white-collar jobs has now being shoved down the income ladder towards lower-income jobs, right? I think I give the example of, like, nannies and childcare workers, and, right, there's, like, other workers like that who their social media identities have become enrolled into their employability in a way that it wasn't the case for those types of jobs before. And I think that that's interesting, right? When we see trends kind of between high wage and low wage workers, we see kind of leakage across the class barrier, right? And so with the pandemic, one of the things I've been thinking about is how workplace surveillance is going in the opposite direction, right? So the workers who have been very used to workplace surveillance, who have been dealing with either direct eyes on them because they're all working in the same on the same factory floor or on the same retail floor, right, or in the same restaurant, the lower wage workers who are used to that kind of surveillance, that those kinds of experiences are being shoved up the income ladder, right? And higher wage workers who are not used to that kind of surveillance are now experiencing it, right? And in the chapter on resistance, I talk about these white collar workers who are kind of poaching time in different kinds of ways, right? So they're in their, you know, white collar office jobs, and they're like using company resources and time to hustle on the side, right? Like for their other kinds of gigs that they have. And I think that that is a privilege that white collar workers have been used to enjoying for a long time, and is maybe becoming a little bit more difficult to do. Although I have to say that, you know, and I haven't done any systematic research on this, but I do remember this like splashy news story during the pandemic about these folks who have two jobs, right? They're like simultaneously holding down two full-time white collar jobs. And I'm just like, maybe that privilege still exists, right? Like, I think that that kind of being able to control your visibility in very strategic ways is still very weighted towards one of those groups, towards the high-wage workers, than it is for the low-wage workers, right? It's just like that privilege continues, I think, even despite these this growing awareness of the ways that white-collar workers are being surveilled. I'm not sure it's in the same ways. I don't think it's to the same depth. I don't think it's in the same ways as the low wage workers that I talk to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I won't name names, but I definitely know people that yeah. were doing the two-job thing. It was absolutely because they could, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, even the way given time or company time was very different. So alongside that, the book does a really good job of breaking down a lot of binaries, dichotomies, assumptions even. So things like, you know, what we've been talking about, you know, white collar professionals and low wage service workers and how that features in the digital gig economy, the global north and the global south. So a lot of the things actually you were talking about how people sort of like access different phone plans and things like that felt really familiar to me because I've experienced those things and I'd never really thought about them in a U.S. context because I also like show up differently here than I do in some of the places I've been. So I found that really, really fascinating. As well as even how we define precarity. So you play around with the term and you problematize it and you talk about how scholars have conceptualized it before and even sort of talked about how inclusion and equality work and the so-called digital divide. So you have a lot to talk about there. So for our listeners who have not yet gotten their hands on the book but need a little teaser, can you outline some of your core claims, your core arguments here, like sort of some really, really some takeaway points that are at the core of the book?
Sure, yeah. to the extent that obviously there's too much to be had in a particular soundbite. You know, one of the kind of aha moments for me in framing the book was really in thinking about like, okay, how have we been talking about this issue of digital inequality so far, right? Before left to our own devices, before I would even say this like more recent like crop of digital inequality scholarship, right? Because I do think there are turns in these trends in the scholarship, is that inequality is largely conceptualized as a problem of exclusion, right? And saying like, okay, the problem is the reason that we have inequality along that we see being patterned through or by digital technologies or access to the internet is because people do not have access, don't have the same type of access, or don't have the same kinds of skills that they need in order to access these technologies, right? Or use them, exploit them to their full potential. And what doing this kind of comparative work between high wage and low wage work, or white collar and, you know, blue collar, no collar work, has shown me is that it's not exclusion, actually. That, you know, I think in reading the book and doing this research, nobody would argue that there are inequalities in between the sets of the two sets of workers, as I kind of categorize them. There are definite inequalities between these two sets of workers. However, those categories or those inequalities are not necessarily patterned by exclusion from access, because the low-wage workers are including themselves at great cost into internet access, into the skills that they need and things like that. And so one of the kind of reframings that I hope I'm able to achieve with the book, along with a host of other scholars who are doing this work along with me, I think, is in kind of trying to shake up this idea, this assumption that exclusion is based on, or inequalities are based on exclusion alone, and instead to say, what are the terms of inclusion and who gets to control those terms? How much power do different sets of people have over determining how they are included into the digital economy, for example, or into even, you know, if the school is your institution of choice, right? Like into school-based systems of digital technology, whatever it might be. So I think kind of changing the type of question that we're asking about inequality is a really important point of this book. And then let me see how we think about precarity. So, and maybe this is for a different kind of audience. This is maybe for a more like comm media, like platform studies audience, I would say. Another key intervention is to say, we need to be looking at these technologies way more widely than we have been, right? There are way more workers who are doing way more types of jobs who matter to us in our understandings of what these technologies are doing in the world than we are currently allowing into our studies. And so we need to have a much broader imagination of the kinds of industries that are being transformed by this, about, and not just like AI is gonna transform everything, not in that kind of way, but in the, like, the very concrete way of, hey, you know, this McDonald's has a Facebook group where they're trading shifts, right? So that's a platform studies issue. Are we studying that right now in platform studies? No, not necessarily, right? Not in the ways that we should be. And so I think being able to actually see actually existing uses of platforms in the workplace, not prospective future transformations of everything by platforms, but actual uses right now, the way that workers are using them and encountering them, that's the, I guess, second kind of intervention or ways that I wanna shake up those binaries that we've been having.
Yeah. So one of the ideas I really held on to was the idea of a digital hustle, and how you sort of track the way that people have been thinking about the hustle to particular racialized economies in the United States. And to me, at least to me, it resonates, but maybe it doesn't, but does it resonate to beyond the United States as a framework that scholars could use, especially as they describe global capitalism?
Yes. Yes, obviously, absolutely. And I should say, you know, I meant what I said at the outset in the introduction that I'm indebted to global communication scholarship, because as a sociologist out on my own in my grad program, when I was looking for scholarship on the ways that workers, especially low-wage workers, were needing digital technologies, I was not reading about workers in the United States. I was reading about post-Soviet countries. I was reading about post-colonial kind of context, right? I was reading about workers in informal labor markets in India, in South Africa, in China, right? From scholars who have been on this beat of low-wage work and technology long before me, right? And so what I see happening on a kind of global scale is actually the trends that have been going on for low-wage workers across the world are coming home to roost in the United States for low-wage workers in a way that we have considered ourselves exceptional for so long, right? Because we have seen these digital technologies as being primarily relevant for white-collar workers, and we kind of stopped being curious about the workers that they were useful for or that they were impacting until Uber and Lyft came along. And then we were like, wait a minute, low-wage workers? You gotta be kidding me, right? Meanwhile, these scholars who have been studying, you know, countries everywhere else outside of the United States have been shouting that, hey, we are using these things, right?
Yeah.
We are seeing workers use these things. So when I think about the, you know, the naming of this thing, the digital hustle, is obviously it comes from, you know, kind of thinking about hustle culture and the way that it's, you know, been valorized and kind of co-opted by capitalism to argue for a particular kind of individual responsibility for income earning. But also as a kind of tribute to say, you know, hey, this stuff has been going on elsewhere for a long time, and we need to catch up as American scholars and as observers of the American kind of labor market.
Yeah, and as we know, I mean, capitalism obviously has been going on for a very long time, and sometimes, I mean, people have been thinking about how to resist or how to have some sort of agency, but it often feels really, really overwhelming. So obviously, like, some of the people that you were speaking with had their ways of coping or their ways of asserting agency, but the problem feels really, really overwhelming. I want to maybe unpack how you've been thinking about agency, especially when we're thinking about, I'm not asking you to solve global capitalism, but like sort of like how do we sit with that without sort of getting overwhelmed by all the things, all the ways that some of these economies kind of getting at us and getting us down.
Yeah. How do we survive? I don't know. But what I can say is, so, you know, thinking about agency for me, like, prompts this, like, post-traumatic graduate school flashback to thinking about the structure and agency, like, debates in sociology over time. So I don't have any kind of fancy words or solution to that, or even necessarily see my book as, like, having anything particularly new to say. But on that, but what I will say is that this, to me, is the strength of long-form, like, qualitative engagement with your informants, your research, or your, you know, the people who you are studying, because it is very rare to meet somebody, I would say, who is actively having to live within these conditions that does not see themselves in some way as an agentic actor. Even if they are, even when they are fully aware of all the things that are aligned against them, right? Yeah. That there are moments, there are, you know, on good days, there are ways that they are in control of, you know, what happens to them and of their, whether they have a bad day or whether they have a good day, you know? And so I think staying close to those interpretations is a part of my obligation as a researcher, right? And to kind of represent those perspectives as real, right? And not necessarily to kind of be a starry-eyed optimist or to be, you know, Pollyanna about it, to say, you know, that this is going to be the solution to bringing down capitalism. No, of course not, right? And these strategies of coping, as I put it in the title, right, exist only because of the system that we are in, right? Yeah. They are a forced adaptation to a bad deal that both sets of these workers are under, right? Albeit, you know, slightly less bad for the higher wage workers, or they're dealing with the same bad situation but with an additional set of privileges that the lower wage workers aren't.
Yeah.
You know, we still got to make do, right? Like, we still have to get up in the morning and, like, decide whether to turn our phones on or not, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's in that kind of, like, practical everyday decision making that, you know, I feel obligated to represent that in the scholarship, because as bad as it is, you know, we make do in a lot of different ways. And so in that chapter is kind of an attempt to show some of those strategies. And I do use the term intentionally, right? Because it does, on the part of these workers that I talk to, these are intentional acts, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
As they do feel that these are things that they are consciously doing to take their time back or to take some control back.
Yeah. And on that point, I had a really, I hope, quick question, sort of about some of the things you say in Suspending the Hustle, and some of that coping. So when I think about coping, mm-hmm. I often look to, I don't know, what have the feminists said about mm-hmm. it? You start talking about how hard it's been for mothers to keep their, some of these boundaries. Mm-hmm. Apart, and sort of how the gig economy manifests here in very gendered mm-hmm, ways mm-hmm, specifically. Mm-hmm. So could you unpack that for us, please? Because I think it's really, it's sort of in line with a lot of what the arguments that feminist scholars have been making for a really, really long time about mm-hmm. that division between home and work, which in the pandemic totally sort of like collapsed. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But Talk to us about sort of the gendered parts of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, this, what I call tethered care work, yeah. right, in the book, is really came from this frustration, I guess, in the scholarship of people talking about work-life boundaries and control, right, over boundaries, in this way that felt like it was like freely floating without any gender, right? Yeah. And it had to do with class, maybe. It had to do with the type of job that you had, but it didn't necessarily have to do with your identity as like a human being with a body and with obligations to other bodies, right? Including children and elderly people and whoever else in your life. And there was also at the time, a lot of, I think this is, stopped to some extent, although I still see it rear its head every once in a while, these kind of more like self-helpy moments that we have where we're like, how do we put down social media? Like, we need to do a digital detox and we need to, whatever. And I say that condescendingly because I'm frustrated with that being the only answer. I'm not saying, that people who do that are silly or that, whatever. The desire for these programs or these words that we have, these terms, come from a very real need that people have in order to cope, right? In order to cope with these systems and to do what they need to in order to like continue on. And so, good for you, right? Like we all find our ways to deal with this stuff. I say this as somebody who is like coming back from maternity leave and had an auto reply on my email. You know what I mean? Right? Like that's a don't talk to me right now, right? Like I do it too. We all do. But is that these kinds of individual approaches to these things are so separate from the expectations that we have largely of women, yeah. For being available all the time, being constantly interruptible all the time. There was, I think, in a great way during the pandemic, this kind of public conversation about the interruptibility of women's time, especially as they're like working at the kitchen table. And they're also being in charge of the homeschooling, right, or the digital school online and things like that, right? I think there was a study that was done, I'm going to forget who, I will find it and you can link to it, about where people worked at home during the pandemic. And, like, overwhelmingly, women worked at the kitchen table and men worked in a bedroom with a door, right? And there was this sense that, like, women were interruptible and men weren't. And when it came to children's demands or children's needs at as they were doing this like impossible work-life explosion that we were expected to do during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I think that, thinking about privacy, thinking about control over our technologies in these individualistic ways occludes these gender dynamics in a really problematic way. And that was made even more obvious during the pandemic, but was also important before.
Yeah. So I know you said the book is not about the future of work. So it's about all the other things we'll be talking about. But as we sit here, I'm really anxious about the future. Mm. We have midterm elections going on
today.
Right now. Yes, people are voting. Mm-hmm. We have all the shenanigans of Twitter that also have me thinking about what precarity means as well, mm-hmm. and like where we thought precarity was and mm-hmm. wasn't. thinking about just like sort of this as a way to think through some of our politics and some of our practices as scholars as well. So I'm hoping you can leave us with sort of some final thoughts, maybe some words of hope, some encouragement, something, just something.
Oh God. So I mean, I would say my big lesson from this book is that. And the only thing that I'll say about the future of work is in the conclusion, is that if the present is as complicated as I have found it to be, in terms of the ways that technology is being integrated into our work, the kind of mutually constructed relationship between precarity and digital technologies, right? So I even talk about how, you know, our phones, right, mostly are a kind of hidden infrastructure. They're a hidden support for precarious work more generally, right? Like, we would not be able to pull off the kinds of scheduling feats that we do with precarious work and demanding the kinds of things that we do of workers without this infrastructure that workers, by the way, pay for, right? It is a complete subsidy to employers on this context, or, you know, businesses in this context, because they're not always employers, that if we have the kinds of complexity that we have right now, that the only thing I can say about the future is it's gonna get more complicated rather than less, right? And I don't say that kind of idly as like, it's complicated, right? But the way that we need to study these things in the future, right? Because that's how I make sense of the world is by studying it. That's where my expertise is. The way that we study these things needs to become more attuned to those complexities, right? And for the purposes of this book, what that means is we cannot limit ourselves to the platforms, to the technologies, or to the uses of them that are defined by tech companies as being important. So, you know, when we look at Twitter, and when we look at the, you know, as the example that you gave, and when we look at the kind of public discourse with a capital P and a capital D, and we hear people saying how important it is for democracy, how important it is for, you know, journalists and things like that, yes, very important to study it under those contexts, but who else is really depending on Twitter in ways that might seem completely unexpected or completely surprising, and which will bite us when those platforms change, right?
Yes.
And I have found that with, I think Facebook is like the best representation of this, right? That we talk about misinformation, disinformation on Facebook. We talk about issues of content moderation on Facebook. What we don't talk about with Facebook is the fact that it is like one of the largest ways that people get and keep contingent in precarious work, right? It is where people advertise their services to their community members. It is where people sell stuff that keeps their bills together, right? Like in between jobs. It's where people swap shifts for their, you know, retail jobs or whatever it is that don't have dedicated apps, you know, for those jobs. It's an ecosystem for the propping up of precarious work in a way that really has not been appreciated all that much, and that needs to be studied more in that way. So I would say if the present is this complicated, the future will only be more so. And we as researchers really need to take that challenge seriously and to complicate our ideas about how to study these things and where to look for the trends. In ways that might make people scratch their heads a little bit, but that are ultimately very important.
Thank you. Thank you so, so much for that. Really appreciate your time. Really appreciate this book. Really appreciate you.
Thank you for reading it.
Had a really great time. Was there anything else you wanted to mention that you want our listeners to know?
Not really. I think we covered a lot of stuff. I would say, you know, in the conclusion, you know, there's always this pressure to like kind of put like policy recommendations, yeah. Which is always a very awkward thing for somebody who is dedicated to this kind of old school notion of social science is like speaking to people's everyday experiences. But what I would encourage folks to do is, if they are interested in these things, is to more so look at the organizations that I call out in the conclusion, the folks who are doing really good work, who know way more than I do about how to leverage these things into actionable policy, who have really creative ideas about how to help people in this very complicated ecosystem. Please check out those organizations, because there are people who have been doing the work for a long time who are more qualified than me to talk about what we should do to ensure this more hopeful future.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We'll definitely check all of that out. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you for listening to our Global Media and Communication podcast. If you have any questions, please feel free to reach out through our email, cargc@asc.upenn.edu, or follow us on Twitter.
Until next time.